Welcome back to the Immunotherapy Podcast. Today, I got to talk with Dr. Cubillos Ruiz. He is on the cutting edge of new immunotherapy research and is now the William J. Ledger, MD, Distinguished Assistant Professor for Infection and Immunology in Obstetrics and Gynecology. He is a member of the Sandra and Edward Meyer Cancer Center and an Assistant Professor of Microbiology and Immunology at Weill Cornell School of Medicine. Dr. Cubillos Ruiz earned his BS from the University of the Andes in Colombia and then received his PhD from Dartmouth Medical School. In 2015, he received the Anne and Sol Schreiber Mentored Investigator Award. In 2016, he was awarded the Ovarian Cancer Academy Early Career Investigator Award. Dr. Cubillos Ruiz is also a Stand Up to Cancer's Innovative Research Grant recipient for studying how certain lipids in the tumor microenvironment inhibit the immune system. In 2017, he was awarded the Parrish Square Stone Cancer Research Grand Prize for seeking to understand the main mechanisms that hinder the immune system's ability to fight the growth of ovarian tumors. The underlying goals of his work have been to research and develop the next generation of more targeted immunotherapies, specifically by targeting immunosuppression in the tumor microenvironment. Dr. Cubillos Ruiz, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Before we get into like talking about your research, you know, I saw that you did your undergrad at University of the Andes in Colombia and then your PhD in Dartmouth. What was getting into research in Colombia like? And then how was it transitioning from that to, you know, Dartmouth in the US?
Sure. That's a great question. Yes, I was born in Colombia. So I lived there for 23 years, you know, and then I majored in microbiology and I always liked science and I always wanted to do a PhD, but it was very challenging and complicated to find programs back home in Colombia. You know, I mean, there's not much funding for basic science. Very few universities offer doctoral programs. And in most of them, you actually had to pay for them, you know, so it was quite complicated, very expensive, you know, and the quality was not great, you know. So when I was finishing my undergrad, I was accepted for a summer research internship at Harvard Medical School. That was in 2003, and I spent the summer and I was working with post and with grad students, and I loved it, you know, and that's what made me realize that I wanted to do a PhD. So then I went back, I finished my undergrad, and then I started applying for grad school to different places, and thankfully ended up at Dartmouth, and then moved to the US in 2005, and that's when I started my PhD. But I switched gears a little bit, so I switched from microbiology to immunology, basically because when I was rotating during the first year, you have three rotations, each one of about 3 months, and I chose different labs to learn a little bit about other topics, and my third rotation was in an immunology lab, and it was actually a tumor immunology lab, and I loved it, so I decided to stay in that lab for my graduate work and for my thesis, and that's how my career as an immunologist started in 2006.
Very cool.
Yeah, so it was going back to the question, it was very complicated. Doing research back home was challenging, and then it was also very challenging for me to start in a new place completely from scratch. Honestly, my English was not great. You know, I never went to a bilingual school, so I had to pretty much learn during the first years. You know, it was complicated, but I had a lot of research experience and I loved it, you know, so in the end, it was a great experience, you know?
That's incredible. I can't imagine trying to pick up a lot of English while simultaneously being in one of these labs where everything's an acronym. And
sure, right. I mean, that part was okay, but the classes were tough. Also, I mean, I come from a huge city back home in Colombia, Bogota. It's almost 10 million people, you know? So moving to Hanover, New Hampshire, where you have 5,000 people, is complicated. So it's a little bit
of, for sure. Yeah,
exactly.
Right. Well, thank you so much. I would love to explain your research or have you explain your research, but if we could just start off, you know, really simply to understand your work, if you could start by explaining the work that you've done on the abnormal endoplasmic reticulum stress response in tumors, and maybe kind of start off by just explaining what the endoplasmic reticulum does and folds proteins and maybe that UPR response.
Perfect. Sounds great. So let's start from the very beginning. Basically, now it is well accepted or well understood that your immune system can recognize cancer cells, right? Just like you are able to recognize viral infections or bacterial infections, you know. Now, cancer cells can be identified by the immune system as something weird. Immunotherapy is precisely this area of research that seeks to exploit or to harness the natural capacity of the immune system to recognize and eliminate cancers, and most importantly, to mount strong and durable memory responses against cancer. So that is beautiful because it's now considered the fourth pillar of cancer treatment, right? So you have surgery, chemotherapy, radiotherapy, and now you have immunotherapy. So basically, there's a lot of excitement because it's been proven clinically that your immune system can put pressure on cancer. And many cancer patients with terminal disease have recovered and are surviving longer after all these different forms of immunotherapy.
There are four main groups of cancer immunotherapies. The first, which we've talked a lot about, are checkpoint blockers, which take the brakes off of the immune cells. There are also adoptive T cell transfer, or CAR T cells, where the immune cells are taken out of the body and modified in some way and then reintroduced. The third type are cancer vaccines, which are vaccines that target specific proteins that cancer cells express. And the fourth group is the one that Dr. Cubijos Ruiz is working on. He is studying how the tumor microenvironment and the tumor mass itself affects the immune cells that have infiltrated it.
It is known that immune cells can spot the cancer cells. They get into the tumor, they start killing them, but very rapidly they become exhausted. Basically, what happens is that they are stressed out. So that's when the ER comes into place, okay? So what is endoplasmic reticulum? The endoplasmic reticulum is a central factory of proteins in the cell, okay? So it's an organelle, is the place where about 30% of your proteins is made, folded, and modified, so they acquire the structure or the 3D conformation that allows that protein to work, okay? So what happens when immune cells infiltrate into the tumor? They get into a very harsh microenvironment that is characterized by lack of oxygen, so the oxygen tension is very small. Then they also don't have nutrients because the cancer cells are proliferating so fast that the cancer cell is stealing the glucose and the glutamine and all the essential amino acids from the immune cell. And they also accumulate a lot of reactive oxygen species or radicals that are toxic. Okay, so basically the immune cell becomes literally stressed out. Those factors affect the function of the ER, of the endoplasmic reticulum. And the endoplasmic reticulum is no longer able to fold or to make the proteins proper. So what we found is that all of those adverse conditions in the tumor compromise the protein folding capacity of the ER, and the immune cell becomes stressed out and initiates a program that stops their functions and their metabolism. So they sense that they're in a horrible environment and they stop working. So basically that's what we found. And basically what we want to do is to counteract that that process, to block the ER stress. We want to develop different approaches or technologies that first enable or allow the immune cell to thrive in that stressful microenvironment, or second, actually shut down the sensors of stress. And that's very cool because we were able to find those sensors. So there are proteins made by the immune cell that are constantly sensing when the immune cell is in a stressful microenvironment.
Dr. Cubijos Ruiz did a really good job of explaining this, but I just want to summarize what he's saying. Immune cells that are in the tumor microenvironment are exposed to stressors such as a lack of oxygen, lack of nutrients like glucose, and exposure to reactive oxygen species which are toxic to the cell. The immune cell, due to these conditions, is no longer able to make proteins correctly in the endoplasmic reticulum, the organelle where proteins are made and processed. And because of this, the cell can no longer carry out its function. Dr. Cubijos Ruiz suggests that if you were to block the signal that senses these toxic conditions, the endoplasmic reticulum would be able to continue to make functioning proteins, and the immune cell would be able to function normally in an environment that it would otherwise be unable to work in. I also want to touch on these sensors of stress. One of these sensors of stress is a protein, which we will mention later, and it is called XBP1. By blocking this protein, XBP1, you can block the stress response from modulating the endoplasmic reticulum's function.
So what we've done is that we can block them. And by blocking them, we make the immune cell ignorant about the stress and they just keep going and can kill the tumor.
Okay. So you're saying the immune cell is able to get to the tumor. It's able to recognize the cancer cells, but because of the toxic conditions of the environment, it has this response where it kind of shuts down and it's no longer able to function.
Exactly.
Does this lead to the death of the immune cell, or does it just lead to it staying in the tumor but not being able to actually attack the cancer cell?
Very good question. So we thought in the beginning that that was going to lead to the death of the immune cell. That was going to kill them, but it's not the case. So the immune cells are still able to get in there, but they're completely anergic. Anergic means that they don't have the energy or the capacity to respond against the cancer cell. So although they're quiescent. Let's say that they're completely asleep in terms of their metabolism and their effect or function. So although they reach the tumor and they start killing some of them, they rapidly shut down their functions.
And so you're saying that if you can block some of the sensors for this stress in the tumor microenvironment, the cell won't respond that way and shut down, but it could continue to work.
Exactly.
So how do you target these sensors of stress?
So we have two approaches. So the first approach, we are developing small molecule inhibitors, let's say drugs, that are able to block the function of the sensors. So let's say that the sensors are proteins that have one specific pocket that becomes activated when there's shear stress, right? So this pocket binds all the misfolded proteins that accumulate. So we have created small molecule inhibitors or drugs that bind that pocket and prevent its interaction with the misfolded proteins and shut down the downstream activation of the pathway. Right. So it's basically just like checkpoint blockers, but that's an antibody, right? In our case, we cannot use antibodies because these are intracellular proteins. They're in the ER. So the antibody wouldn't get into the ER. But a small molecule inhibitor can go through the cell membrane and reach the ER and then bind that pocket and then shut down the overactivation of the stress sensor. Okay. So that's the first one. And the second one is actually exploiting genetics. So we've been exploiting two different strategies. The first one is CRISPR-Cas or genome editing technologies, where you can basically take the immune cells out of the patient, use CRISPR-Cas system to pretty much cut and remove that region in the genome and make immune cells that don't express the stress sensor and then put them back into the patient, right? That's what we're trying to do. So far, we have only done it in mice and it's working very, very well. It's basically like genome surgery. It's microsurgery where you can remove one piece and then put the two fragments of DNA back together.
So off of that, if you were to do this, you know, in a human, would you take the immune cells out of the human, reprogram them kind of with the CRISPR-Cas system, and then reintroduce them into the patient?
Absolutely. That's the idea. Okay. And people have done it, actually. So there are clinical trials by multiple investigators, for example, taking T cells out of the patient and knocking out PD-1, for example, in the lab, and then reinfusing back those CRISPR-Cas modified T cells, and they seem to work better. In our case, it would not be PD-1, but it would be our sensors of stress that we have identified, right? So that's the idea. And the second approach is actually using small interfering RNA. I don't know if you're familiar with the siRNA, which is RNA interference, basically are just short double-stranded RNA molecules that can interfere with the expression of genes, mm-hmm. right? siRNA. So we have created nanoparticles that encapsulate those molecules. And then you can deliver them into the tumor microenvironment. Immune cells take up those nanoparticles. And then the payload, which is the siRNA, is delivered into the cell. And then you shut down gene expression. So you do not delete or remove that gene, but you knock it down. So it's a knockdown, okay, of the expression. So that's what we've
done. Okay.
Those are the strategies.
So these therapeutic approaches are pretty complicated, but they all work by reducing the ability of the immune cell's endoplasmic reticulum from sensing stress. As Dr. Cubillos Ruiz was discussing, this can be done by a small drug that blocks the receptor from sensing stress. It can be done by genetically altering the cell so that it no longer makes the stressor receptor, or it can be done by using siRNA inside of a nanoparticle, which works in a manner more complex than we should get into in this podcast, but is able to reduce the expression of these stress sensors. Dr. Cubillos Ruiz has also looked into how these stress sensors, such as XBP1 and IRE, can augment a checkpoint inhibitor's effectiveness.
Could you talk a little bit more about how you could have that interaction between a checkpoint inhibitor and
Absolutely. So there's a lot of interest in understanding why some patients respond well to checkpoint blockers and why the other half or more than half are still resistant to checkpoint blockers, right? So there's a lot of research going on trying to identify the mechanisms of resistance to checkpoint blockers, right? And we and others have postulated that maybe that stress response, the ER stress response, is a mechanism of resistance, right? That although you are trying to release the brakes by blocking the interaction with PD-1 and PD-L1 or CTLA-4 with its ligand, it's not sufficient because the immune cell is stressed out, right? So if you have a car, let's say you have a Ferrari, I mean, of course, you need to step off the brakes, right? But you need gas to run, okay? So if they don't have gas, they will never be able to respond to checkpoint blocker, right? So even if you remove the brakes, release the brakes, if you don't have gas, the T cells, the immune cells will never run. So we believe that they don't run because they are stressed out, because their metabolism is shut down, because they're anergic, okay? So you can keep treating patients as much as you want with checkpoint blockers, and they will never respond because there are additional mechanisms of immunosuppression in the tumor above and beyond checkpoint blockers. There are now papers by other groups, very interesting, showing two different things. The first one is that in melanoma patients that have been treated with checkpoint blockers, in this case, anti-CTLA-4, those patients that responded, let's say 40% of them, all of them had lower levels of ER stress responses in the tumor before the start of the treatment, while all the non-responders had a significant increase in the expression levels of all the ER stress gene markers, right? Suggesting that that's just a correlation. So then other investigators have shown that you can actually knock out or inhibit those ER stress sensors in the immune cell. And now the T cells become better at responding to the checkpoint blocker, okay? So that's the interaction. So we believe that there's a new opportunity to improve the efficacy of cancer immunotherapy by targeting the tumor microenvironment and more specifically the overactivation of ER stress sensor. So we started working on this pathway almost 6 years ago, and now many other investigators are working on that and are actually thankfully expanding on our findings and finding new combination treatments that we hope to see in the clinic in the next couple of years.
This is so interesting because the varied degrees of response in patients on checkpoint inhibitors can be so great. Some patients, it works really well in, and others, it really has no effect. The mechanism for checkpoint inhibitors resistance and potential markers for these drugs' abilities to work is an area of intense research. And it makes sense that the ER stress response could be a mechanism of resistance. If the immune cell is stressed and unable to function correctly, it would not matter if the immune cell was being inhibited by the PD-1 or CTLA-4 systems.
Very interesting.
Right.
Do you imagine when this does become a target, a therapy, would it be used concurrent with the checkpoint inhibitor, or do you think it would be used kind of beforehand to allow the checkpoint inhibitor to work better?
That's a great question. I would prefer to give the modulators of ER stress before treatment with checkpoint blockers, right? To reactivate the immune cell, to ramp up their metabolism, to shut down that overexpression of those pathways, and then sensitize them to the checkpoint blocker. Okay, for example, let me give you an example. What we have seen is that when you control the hyperactivation of stress sensors, you make dendritic cells more capable of presenting tumor antigens to the T cells. So then if we use a molecule or a strategy that shuts down that ear stress that is detrimental to the dendritic cell, now the dendritic cell would be able to present those neoantigens or tumor antigens to the T cell, which will activate the T cell, will give the antigen, and then it will respond to checkpoint blocker. So then you can release the brakes because you have the gas. Mm-hmm. The gas is the antigen presentation.
Right.
And so I would imagine in a perfect world that you would give it first to condition the host, to sensitize the host, the patient.
Right.
And then give the checkpoint blocker, but I may be completely wrong. Yep. And maybe you have to give the checkpoint blocker first, and then, but that's the beauty of the clinical trials.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit more about the biology that Dr. Cubillos Ruiz is talking about here. Dendritic cells are immune cells, and they are known as antigen presenting cells. An antigen presenting cell is one that can present foreign material. And in this example, it would be proteins that the cancer cell has made. The antigen presenting cell presents this cancer protein or antigen to the immune cell that actually attacks and kills the cancer cell. The cell that kills the cancer cell is called the cytotoxic T cell. The cytotoxic T cell requires this presentation of foreign antigen in order for it to become activated and attack the cancer cell. Dr. Cubillos Ruiz is saying that you would want to give the sensitizing drug early in order to allow full presentation of antigen by dendritic cells to cytotoxic T cells.
So you see this hyperactive ER stress response in both the dendritic cell and the cytotoxic T cell?
In both, and now we have evidence and other people have shown that also in the cancer cell. So those inhibitors, I mean, those blockers of ER stress, let's say, would be a triple whammy. So you enhance the function of the dendritic cell, you make the T cell smarter and actually more metabolically agile, so fitter, and then the cancer cell less pro-tumorigenic and less aggressive, because many other groups have shown in other models, especially in breast cancer, that overactivation of the stress sensor in the cancer cell promotes resistance to chemotherapy, promotes resistance to other targeted therapies, and promotes metastasis. So the beauty of this pathway is that it seems to operate in a cancer cell intrinsic manner. So it promotes tumor growth by modulating the function of the cancer cell and also by suppressing the normal function of the immune system.
Dr. Cubillos Ruiz's work has also shown a connection between the ER stress response and the availability of glucose in the tumor microenvironment. He has published papers indicating that the ER stress response through the IRE1-XBP1 pathway is able to control the functioning of immune cells by regulating their mitochondrial activity. Glucose is a nutrient that cells require to make energy called ATP, but it is also used in the ER to help the processing of proteins. Proteins are all made inside of the endoplasmic reticulum, but they are contained throughout the cell as well as outside of the cell. So how do they get to where they need to go? When a protein has been made, it becomes glycosylated. Glycosylation is the addition of sugars or glucose molecules to the end of the amino acid chain. This addition of sugars can serve as a signal for where the protein should be sent out. Without this glycosylation, the cell will be unable to function. The other thing that happens when there is no glucose is that the cell will need to find another source of energy. It does this by breaking down proteins into amino acids. He has also shown that the ER stress response is able to inhibit this process as well.
So basically, the cancer cells are able to outcompete the immune cells for nutrients, and this can change, or you can alter the metabolism of the immune cells, and that can lead to them not working quite as well. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about this mechanism and some of your work in it?
Sure. This was found about 5 years ago. It's called metabolic competition, right? Where the cancer cells are competing for nutrients and stealing the nutrients from the immune cell, right? So let's take a very simple example, glucose. Glucose is essential for any cell type to make energy, ATP, right? So if the cancer cell is addicted to glucose, they love to eat glucose and to consume glucose, and they use it all the time, you know, for glycolysis to generate ATP and to divide and to expand. So the problem is that glucose is also extremely important in the immune cell. Okay, so glucose for the immune cell is essential for making energy. But also what we found, and others, you know, but our interpretation was a little bit different, is that glucose is essential in the immune cell also for protein folding in the ER. Okay, so one of the key functions of the ER is protein glycosylation, which means that the N-terminus of the protein receives some carbohydrates made from glucose, right? They're called complex glycans. And only when that N-terminus, that end of the protein is glycosylated, that protein becomes functional and can leave the ER. So if you don't have glucose, you affect protein glycosylation in the ER, and that causes ER stress, okay? So if the cancer cell is stealing glucose all the time from the immune cell, of course, the immune cell will not have energy for glycolysis, but at the same time, it will undergo persistent chronic ER stress responses because the glucose is never there. So that's why the pathway is never shut down. It becomes persistently and cyclically activated. In fact, one of the functions of IRE1-XBP1 throughout evolution, you know, this is from yeast, is actually to turn on the genes that enable the utilization of glucose for protein glycosylation. So just imagine the immune cell doesn't have glucose, turns on the ER stress response. It should be transient, okay? It should be activated during periods of stress and then shut down because the persistent activation is bad. Okay, so what happens to the immune cell is that it will never shut down that arm of the ER stress response, the IRE1-XBP1. So the cell starts sensing that stress, and the same pathway then shuts down other metabolic processes that are supposed to support the immune cell in the absence of glucose. So that's what we found. So when the immune cell doesn't have glucose, the first thing that that cell should do is to take glutamine or amino acids to incorporate it into the mitochondria for mitochondrial respiration and ATP generation. But what we found is that that stress response factor, XBP1, controlled the expression of the glutamine transporters. Right? Because it's telling the cell, okay, you have to stop everything. Stop generating energy, stop building DNA and amino acids and proteins because there is not enough, right? So in doing so, the immune cell is unable to kill the cancer cell.
Interesting. Have you guys found any way to target this as a therapy?
Different strategies. So we're not the only ones. Our group found that targeting the ER stress response can be used to rewire the metabolism of the immune cell, right? But other people, other groups in amazing ways have shown that they can also target the upstream pathways in the metabolic processes of the T cell to reroute those metabolites, to rewire them and to make them more available for glycolysis and to increase the level of energy. So yeah, there's a lot of interest, you know. Now, if you think about it, it's an understanding how the metabolic status of the immune cell will determine also its capacity to respond to immunotherapies. And it makes sense because, again, you can hit the patient very hard with those antibodies blocking PD-1, but if the metabolism of the cell is compromised, the cell is shut down, it will never work. Those are all the different strategies that investigators are considering, you know, for enhancing the efficacy of cancer immunotherapy.
Being a leader in the field, I also wanted to get Dr. Cubillos Ruiz's opinion on what he finds to be most exciting with the future of immunotherapies.
So kind of switching gears here, you kind of talked earlier about CAR T cell therapy and TIL cell transfer and cancer vaccine. Is there anything in those fields that you're like most excited for or what has stood out to you?
Well, I'm very impressed by the different technologies and strategies that people are using to reprogram the T cells that will be infused back into the patient. So not only the generation of new CAR types, right? New chimeric antigen receptor types, but also how you can manipulate other pathways in the T cell at the same time to make it stronger and to make it better equipped to function in an aggressive tumor microenvironment. That's one. The second one is also along the same lines, how you can create off-the-shelf CAR T cells, because I think right now it's very complicated because it's ultra-personalized immunotherapy where you have to tailor those T cells for the patient. You know, takes months to generate the billions of T cells that you need to reinfuse. Of course, that's going to get streamlined, but if you can generate a universal class of CAR T cells, that's going to be amazing, right? This is something that works for everyone. From from our perspective, we're trying to enhance CAR T cell function by targeting the stress sensors, for example. Mm-hmm. So we want to see if by knocking out those genes, we can make the CAR T cells better. So other area that I find to be very exciting is the potential vaccines, you know, finding those neoantigens expressed by the cancer cell very early on to attempt prophylactic vaccinations against cancer or also therapeutic vaccinations against cancer, right? And the third one, as I mentioned, which is my favorite one, is modulating the tumor microenvironment. So how can you make that tumor more hospitable for the T cell or for the immune cell? There's a lot going on. And also, as I mentioned before, really trying to understand why some patients respond to checkpoint blockers and why the majority of them still don't, right?
Right. Thank you so much. Those are all the questions that I have.
Perfect.
Do you have any questions for me or anything else you'd like to mention?
I would say that a lot of excitement for immunotherapy, but we still need a lot of research. This is just the beginning. This is just the tip of the iceberg. You know, there's a lot of excitement. There's a lot of combination treatments going on. Of course, I mean, patients are very hopeful about these treatments, and that's the way it should be. But we still need to understand very, very deeply and mechanistically how immunotherapy works, why some tumor types are refractory to immunotherapies. And maybe the third message that I think would be important to convey is that immunotherapy, in most cases, should not be one size fits all. I think that's been a mistake, you know, thinking that checkpoint blockers should work as effectively in pancreatic cancer patients or ovarian cancer patients as they do in lung cancer patients or melanoma patients, okay? So I think that each tumor type is a completely different universe. Of course, there are some conserved mechanisms that can be exploited for therapeutic purposes, but understanding the particular or the exclusive mechanisms that make some tumor types more aggressive than others is essential, you know, essential for creating immunotherapies that will be successful in the clinic. Okay, so that's why basic research is extremely important, and that's why a deep mechanistic characterization of the different tumor types as independent entities is also fundamental.
And
great.
You explained it super clearly, very thoroughly. So it's pretty complex biology that you're able to really present very nicely. So thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Well, I want to let you get off to your weekend. So,
perfect. All right.
Thank you so much for your time.
Take care. Have a nice weekend.
Thank you all so much for listening to this conversation with Dr. Cubijos Ruiz. He really is on the cutting edge of some of the most exciting research that is out there. If you're interested in learning more about his work, I will post some links to some of his research on my website at www.immunotherapypodcast.com. That's immunotherapy podcast, all one word. If you have any questions, feel free to post them on the forum and I can answer them. And as always, thank you so much for listening and stay posted for the next episode.